This week's parsha is Parshas Noach, as we start the book of Bereishis again. We missed last week, although we're going to try to tie things together a little bit. Obviously, the main feature of this week's parsha is the flood. That is the main feature. Humanity becomes completely morally corrupt, and completely and moral decay sets into the point where everything is just completely falling apart. And so God says that I'm going to destroy the world, and I'm going to start again, world 2.0, with just Noah and his family, and we'll see where things go from there. Things don't go great after that, because the Torah continues afterwards that with what's known as the Tower of Babel, the Tower of Babel, where all of society gets together to build a tower. And although the verses themselves, you read the verses, are extremely unclear what exactly is going on. However, the oral Torah explains to us, and Rashi expands on this, that they were trying to create a tower to reach the heavens, to wage war against God. Now, from a purely scientific standpoint, trying to build a tower to reach the heavens to wage war against God is very, very unlikely to succeed. Okay. And what exactly they were trying to do with this tower is the subject of a lot of discussion. There are sources that say that this tower was actually meant as a gigantic, enormous temple to their God, and they were trying to marshal the spiritual forces of creation to take control, spiritual control of creation from God. That's what they were trying to do. They were trying to wrest control of creation from God himself by kind of like using God's structure, spiritual structure of the world against him to wrest control of it from him. Based on the way God set up the structure, it should have worked. However, God has a kill switch, which God can just override all the natural, including spiritual natural forces, and that God kind of triggered that kill switch. And the way he did it was he came down, he jumbled their language, and he scattered them throughout the world. Okay, but that was in a nutshell, and that's not my discussion today. In a nutshell, that was what they were trying to do, was they were trying to use their idolatrous and their knowledge of the spiritual structure of the world to wrest control of the spiritual of creation from God. Okay, that's what they're trying to do. And then the parasha ends with 10 generations from Noah until a man named Avram, who is going to be a major player on the world scene in the coming weeks. The Torah tells us that Avram leaves his birthplace of Ur Kasdim. In English, it's called, I think, Ur of Chaldees or something like that. He makes his, and he leaves there with his father, and they go to a place named Haran. And that is kind of where the parsha ends off. So we meet this man named Avram at the end of the parsha, and reading between the lines of the final verses of the parsha, the Torah tells us that Avram's brother Haran died during his father Terah's lifetime. Rashi, expanding on this, again, very vague declaration, says that what had happened was that Avram had come to the realization that there must be one all-powerful creator on his own, okay, through his own philosophical thoughts and debates within himself. And the problem was, this was not a popular viewpoint at this point in world history. It was a very polytheistic society. And Avram began walking around declaring a monotheistic religion. This was very much at odds with the rest of society. And the king, Nimrod, was very unhappy with Avram, and he tries to cast him into a fiery furnace. Not he tries, he does. However, miraculously, God saves Avram from the fiery furnace. Haran, who is a bystander watching this whole scene, seeing the miraculous deliverance of Avram from Nimrod's attempt to execute him, throws in his lot, more about lot soon, throws in his lot with Avram, and Nimrod says, okay, we'll throw you into the furnace also. But Haran is not on the same spiritual level as Avram. He's, you know, jumping on the bandwagon a little too late, and therefore he does not merit a miraculous deliverance, and so Haran dies. Although Haran dies dedicating himself to his newfound religious belief. But he does die, and like I said, he throws in his lot with Avram, quite literally, because Lot is Haran's son, and now orphaned of his father, Lot ends up joining up with Avram. And Lot has a sister who the Torah tells us is named Yiska. Yiska is none other than Sarai, who will later become Sarah, whom Avram marries. So Avram marries his niece, and so Lot, besides being Avram's nephew, is also his brother-in-law. Something to think about when we talk about family entanglements. So that is the end of the parasha. Okay, that is the parasha in a nutshell. Here's what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about the founding of the Jewish people. There is a very, very interesting question, and that is, when did the Jewish people begin? Did the Jewish people begin with Avram devoting himself to a single all-powerful creator? Does he begin the Jewish people? Do the Jewish people begin with the 12 tribes? Do the Jewish people begin when they go into Egypt and become enslaved? Do the Jewish people begin when they leave Egypt? Or do the Jewish people begin when they stand at Sinai and receive the Torah and God says, you will be a holy nation unto me, a nation of priests, you will be to me. Which one? When do the Jewish people begin? This is a source of an enormous amount of discussion and debate. There's a lot of evidence that the Jewish people already began with the patriarchs, with Avram. There is a lot of other evidence to indicate that the Jewish people began when the Jewish people received the Torah at Sinai, including the verses themselves. God tells the Jewish people, you will be my nation, a nation of priests, which indicates that this only happens when they receive the Torah. On the other hand, God constantly tells Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, the patriarchs, as well as Moshe in Egypt, that this is my people. I'm going to save them from Egypt. I swear to save them from Egypt and to make them my people, and so on and so forth, which indicates that there's already something going on well before that. So again, it's a very, very lengthy discussion, but I want to try to focus today on the idea of what was unique about Avram that others before him failed. There were other great people who came before Avram. You have Adam, you have Chase, Seth, Adam's son, who was also a very great person. You have Methuselah, not the tree in California, but it's named after Methuselah, who is, according to the Torah, the longest living person in the history of the world. I believe 969 years, according to the Torah, he lived thereabouts, and he was a very righteous person. You have Chanoch, whom the Torah says explicitly was a very righteous person. Noach, the Torah says, was a righteous person. Noach's son Shem was a righteous person. You got lots of righteous people who serve God in the Torah before Avram, yet somehow only Avram makes the leap to get this relationship with God where God says, your descendants will be my nation. Okay? So what did Avram achieve that these other nations did not achieve? So let's go back to last week's parasha, the parasha's Bereshis, to explore this question. And we're going to tie together Bereshis and Noach, this week's parasha, and it'll carry us already into next week's parasha, into the story of Avram and his development as a person and into the nascent growth of the Jewish people. And with that, we can try to get a better understanding of the roots of the Jewish nation and what is starting and beginning over here. When Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, remember that last week? Okay. It's clear in the Torah, and it's discussed at even greater length in the Talmud, other Midrashic sources, that it wasn't just that they got a bunch of punishments, that Adam and Eve got a bunch of punishments when they ate from the tree. It wasn't like, things didn't really change that much, except that now they would die, and now there would be difficult pregnancies and childbirth and child raising and so on. No, the world changed fundamentally in many ways. One major way, okay, in which the world changed is that the world went from being an internal world to an external world, meaning previously you experienced the world primarily through its spiritual content. That was how you perceived the world. Now you perceive the world externally. You see the physical external content of the world, and you have to do a lot of digging to reach and to recognize and to have a sense of the spiritual content of the world. That was one major change. If you want a basic idea of this, just as an example, okay, if you look at an example just in our context, if you look at a person or anything in the world, you will not really think about the fact that that individual is made up of molecules and many, many, countless billions and billions and billions of atoms. not Adams and Eves. Adams, A-T-O-M-S. As someone once said, never trust an atom because they make up everything. So anyways, but in any event, you don't look at the person that way. Okay. That is the reality, but you don't look at the person that way. Why? Because you see a very externalized physical picture of the person, and that's what you perceive as the external physical version of the individual. You don't focus on the fact that there's billions and trillions of atoms making up the person, or for that matter, making up the chair or the screen that you're looking at right now, or so on. You don't think of it that way. You don't look at the screen that you're looking at right now, or the phone that you are looking at, and think about the fact that there are many, probably billions of electronic signals and impulses that are creating the picture that you're seeing or the sound that you're hearing. You perceive it as sound, you perceive it as a picture, and that's it. Okay? You're missing the underlying internal structure. By the same token, the world consists of a spiritual structure, and that spiritual structure evolves, or really devolves, into a physical world. It begins from God himself, and then it comes down layer by layer by layer, world by world by world, one spiritual world after another, and it gradually becomes fleshed out into a physical entity. So Adam and Eve, living in a world before they ate from the tree of knowledge, perceived the spiritual content of the world. And consequently, they were able to make a much greater spiritual reality as part of their lives. That was the world they lived in. Now, after they ate from the tree, they perceive everything in a much more physical fashion. And consequently, connecting to the spiritual content is much, much more challenging. That's not the world that we live in. Okay? Connected to that is the following idea. That Adam and Eve, or humanity in general, when originally created, were actually connected to all of these spiritual worlds, such that whenever a human would have done something, it doesn't just affect the physical world, but rather it affects everything above you as well. Okay, it's described in some Kabbalistic sources as if, you know, you're kind of attached to a bunch of strings. You're almost like a puppet master pulling strings. And what you do down here pulls strings in all the worlds above you. And whatever you do, it affects all those worlds above you, and it basically affects the entirety of creation. Everything in creation is tied to mankind, to humanity. Whatever humanity doesn't just affect himself, it affects the entirety of the universe. Consequently, when Adam and Eve eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, it doesn't just affect them, it affects everything in the entirety of the universe, because whatever they do is they are attached, they are kind of pulling the strings to everything around them. So whatever they do is affecting everything around them. After they ate from the tree, that ability to connect, to affect everything around them was very greatly diminished and almost completely cut off. So now when Adam and Eve or their descendants do something, they do it, it affects their physical world. It does not drastically affect the world around them. It does not drastically affect the world around them in a spiritual sense. It may affect, you know, if you chop down a tree, the tree is chopped down. But if I obey God's command, so previously, if I obeyed God's command, if I did a mitzvah, yes, they had limited mitzvahs, but if I did a mitzvah, that mitzvah brought spiritual positivity and power into the entirety of the world. And if one did something wrong, it brought spiritual negativity into the entirety of the world. Now that they ate from the tree, they cut themselves off from that internal world. Now they're living in an externalized world. They're not connected to that internal spiritual world. Everything has changed.
Okay? Question. They're not connected.
God gave the opportunity to Adam and Eve after they ate from the tree. God said, okay, you guys crashed the world. Now you've got to go out and engage the world and fix it. And here we have the origins of a much abused term, Tikkun Olam. Okay, and as I mentioned many times in this class, the word Tikkun Olam today is used for just about anything that people feel like using it, anything from saving the polar bears to stopping climate change to social justice to trying to pass multi-trillion-dollar bills through Congress for who knows what. That's all under the banner of Tikkun Olam, and therefore it's all a mitzvah. Just hang on one second, I'll take your question. That is really a gross abuse of the term. The term Tikkun Olam actually, and I think, again, I've mentioned this in the past, is found in the Aleinu prayer that we say thrice daily after Shacharis, Mincha, and Ma'ariv, after three daily prayers. We say that our goal, we look forward to the world being l'taken olam, to fix the world. You could stop there, but the next two words are vital. B'malchus Shakai, with the kingdom of God. So the idea of fixing the world is to fix the world, to make it the kingdom of God. The mission that Adam and Eve had after crashing the world was to rectify and reattach themselves spiritually to God, and thus bring the world back to a spiritually manifesting world rather than a mere physically manifesting world. That was their mission that God gave them. And God told them, you go out of the Garden of Eden, you're not here anymore, you've got to go out, you've got to work the earth, you've got to sweat, you've got to toil. It wasn't not just the physical world. You don't just have to sweat and toil to make food. It's you have to now sweat and toil to bring the world back to a spiritually, primarily spiritual world that's connected, rather than one that just is externalized and manifests the physical world. Okay, and that was the mission they were given. Yes, go ahead. You had a question or a comment?
Yeah, it sounds like what you're saying is that Adam and Eve were, you've heard the term, I suppose, the law of unintended consequences, but that's not what they had. They could actually see the consequences. So if they could see the consequences when they transgressed, why didn't they know ahead of time that it wasn't going to work the way that they wanted it to work?
That is an excellent, that's a great question. The short answer, I could give a whole class on this question, but the short answer is that they thought that it would work out better. Let me explain that short answer in a slightly better fashion. And that is as follows. Adam and Eve understood that God put them in the world to achieve great things. They weren't just here, you know, to walk around like cows eating grass. Okay. God gave them the free will, gave them the ability to choose between good and evil. That means God put them here for a purpose. They understood that very keenly. The problem was that they did not have a drive for evil. Evil was this external force outside of them. They were not tempted. So God told Adam and Eve, all I need you to do is sit tight and don't do anything. Don't bring evil into yourself. By eating from that tree, what you're going to do is you're going to bring evil into yourself and into the world. In other words, you're going to externalize yourself. Okay, again, it needs a much broader discussion. I don't have a lot of time here, but and you know, one aspect of evil in the world is that it is cut off from God. It's a world that's very externalized and superficial, as opposed to a spiritually rich, connected to God world. Okay, Adam and Eve had to make the following choice: do we listen to God and not do anything, and let God just perfect the world on His own? In which case, we've been given all of these powers, but we're not really doing anything with them. We're just sitting tight and not using them. Or do we crash the world and then struggle to choose good over evil and thereby perfect the world through our own efforts? That was the terrible choice they had to make. And God told them, I'm telling you, it's not worth it. It's a really bad idea to try and separate good from evil on your own, because it's a terribly difficult struggle and you're going to have a real hard time doing it. Look at us today. It's really not a simple matter to choose good over evil consistently and to really separate the two and put evil back, you know, so to speak. Once the genie's out of the bottle, it's very hard to put it back. In this case, once the snake is out of the bottle, right? Once evil is out of the bottle, you're going to have a mighty hard time stuffing it back in again. Okay, but that was, so what they chose, no, we'll do it. God, you put us here to achieve great things, and we want to realize your purpose in creation by doing it. And so what they essentially did was they said, you know, God, you're kind of challenging us to sit tight and not do anything, but really we believe that you want us to do this and to take the challenge and to overcome it. Okay, and so they made that choice. Where did they go wrong? Seemingly they had all the right intentions in mind. Well, where they went wrong is because to some degree their decision was ego-driven, right? Because if I want to achieve something, then that's my ego kicking in. To some degree, there was enough of a sense of self, of ego, to lead them down the wrong path. If they would have been completely subjective in their decision, they would have realized it's a terrible move to bring evil into themselves, into the world, okay, and to let that genie out of the bottle. But because there was enough of a sense of self, of a sense of ego, to say, I can accomplish such great things, that clouded their vision, again, at their very, very great spiritual level, and they made the wrong choice. So that is a medium-sized answer to what is really a very large, a very, very excellent and large question, okay? But your question and my brief answer really just reinforces the point I'm making, and that is that what they now had to do was separate good from evil. When God tells Adam, you're going to have to work the earth, right? And by the sweat of your brow, you will eat bread. That is true physically. The Talmud says that before they ate from the tree, the food just popped up on the plant ready to eat. Now you've got a plant. You've got a plow, you've got a plant, you've got a weed. You've got a water. You've got a harvest. You've got a process. You've got to remove all the impurities, the chaff. You have to grind it. You have to bake it. It's a massive, massive hassle to separate the food from the earth. There are massive challenges involved. Okay, the world has advanced today technologically to make it easier, but it's still a huge amount of work to get a loaf of bread from the ground, from the earth. And a spiritual level, spiritually, the idea is the earth is looked at as the physical world, right? God tells Adam and Eve, you have come from earth and you shall return to the earth. And the point is you need to struggle with the earth to put it, the physical world, back in its place and to pull out the spiritual content from it. Okay, so that struggle with the earth is true physically. You've got to struggle with the earth to pull out a loaf of bread. And also spiritually, you've got to struggle with the earth to pull the goodness, the spiritual content from what looks like a very externalized physical world. That's their struggle. Okay, and God gave mankind enormous gifts, long life, a nice climate, abundant food, and so on, a wonderful environment in which they could engage in this activity of struggling with evil and overcoming it. Instead, what happened was mankind, as the Torah tells us, mankind abused these gifts of goodness from God. Instead of taking all of these gifts and using them as a means to serve God and bring the world back to God and reconnect, so to speak, the pipeline of the world back to God again, to its spiritual source. Instead, mankind took it and abused it and totally corrupted it. Torah makes that clear, right? What tends to happen to society, and this is true throughout history, it's very true for the Jewish people, but you'll see it in society itself. When things are difficult, people tend to turn inwards, to be more reflective, and so on. Just as a very basic example in recent history, during the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties, as they were known, which was a very externalized, superficial world. I never read The Great Gatsby, but that seems to be, from what I understand, the theme of the entire book, is the superficiality and the shallowness of the world of the Roaring Twenties, when things were great and there was lots of money and lots of bootleg booze and whatnot running around. So the moral structure of society fell apart. Well, in 1929, it all came crashing down, quite literally. And I once read somewhere, that during the Roaring Twenties, the hemlines on skirts went up. And during the 1930s, the hemlines came back down again. All right. And the point was that modesty, morality, decayed during the 20s in America. And during the 1930s, morality became a thing again. And kind of stayed that way until like the late 50s with the baby boomer generation, until the 60s when everything fell apart again. Anyways, But that's not my discussion today. The point I'm making is that there's a tendency in humanity that when there's a lot of physical goodness to go around, instead of using it to serve God, what tends to happen is people tend to abuse it. They tend to get sucked in to the pleasures that the world offers, and they forget about God. Okay? And when there's less, then people start to think, what am I living here for? It's not just how much I can drink, how much I can eat, how many people I can have relationships with, and so on and so forth. That's not what life is about. And they become, they turn inwards. But really, ideally, and the Torah makes this point clear, God gives us abundant blessing for the purpose of using it to serve him properly. And the challenge is that we tend to abuse it. That's what happened over here in this generation. God is telling Adam, and God is telling Eve, and God is telling their descendants, you have this great opportunity to fix up what you messed up. Take what I'm giving you and use it to serve me. And by doing so, you will be rejecting the crass, physical material world of pleasures, of temptations, of power, of ego, of lust, reject all that and use the good health, use the wonderful climate, use the long life and all the material goodness that you have to serve me. And by doing so, you will be reconnecting the physical world with its source, with God. Alas, that's not what happened. Okay, and so even though you had an individual like Noah, who was a very righteous individual, who did not get sucked into this whirlpool or cesspool of moral decay, however, and Noah was righteous enough to merit to be miraculously saved by God from the destruction of the world, Noah was not on a level to actually reconnect the physical world with the spiritual. That far he did not get. Okay, and here's the proof in the pudding. What happens after the flood? What does Noah do? He plants a vineyard. Okay. Now, according to one opinion in the Talmud, the original tree, there are different opinions, but according to one opinion, the original tree of knowledge of good and evil in the Garden of Eden was none other than, you got it, grapes. Okay. Grapes. In other words, alcohol was the source of original sin. And alcohol is what brought down Noah as well after the flood. Think about alcohol for a minute. Alcohol, when used properly, has the capacity to do a lot of good. I'm not just talking about the purported health benefits of a glass of red wine every day. Okay, in a general sense, we use alcohol in Judaism, wine specifically, all the time, right? We use wine to reach a higher spiritual plane because if used in a measured, proper, limited sense, if you're able to keep it under control, then it can open you up. Too much, it can make you, you know, it can open your mind up, it can make, put you in a much better mood to achieve great things, okay? However, if it's abused, then it rains destruction down upon the one who's abusing it, okay? And so, hence, as I mentioned before, you know, I alluded to the era of prohibition in America, you know, during the first decades of the 20th century. The reason was because society had become so inebriated that, you know, the temperance movements, led by women, of course, who were sick of their husbands getting drunk all the time, you know, gained enough steam to pass an amendment to ban alcohol in the United States. That's how out of control it became, with religious exemptions, of course. So, you know, just like today, marijuana is only used for medicinal purposes, then also alcohol is only used for religious purposes as well. But it's ironic. The religious purpose of alcohol is really what it's meant to be used for. So what happens? Noah comes out of the Teva. He comes out of the ark. And what does he do? He plants a vineyard. Why a vineyard of all things? He's criticized for doing this. But sources say that what he was trying to do was, he was trying to fix the sin of Adam. Noah figured the world was just destroyed. God put me here. Let's try to fix everything back right now. Let's try to reconnect. I'm going to take that original fruit that brought Adam and Eve down, and I'm going to bring it under my control. I'm going to reject the evil side of it, the temptation side of it, and I will only use it for the positive spiritual side. It didn't work. What happens? Noah drinks, he becomes drunk and exposed in his tent. In other words, Noah attempted to go back to the state of Adam in the Garden of Eden, but he was unable to conquer the evil, the temptation that was present in the wine. So Noah is thus out of the running for being that person who's going to reconnect heaven with earth. God is waiting, he's waiting, he's waiting, generation after generation. Who's going to be the one who's going to take the steps? Will humanity take the plunge? Will they manage to be able to reconnect? And it's not happening, it's not happening, it's not happening. And in fact, says the Torah, it goes so far that it's not happening that it gets to a point where mankind says, you know, not only are we not interested in reconnecting the world with God, we want to completely disconnect it and take it over ourselves. We're going to build a massive temple. We're going to utilize all the spiritual power we can get our hands on to wrest control of creation from God. Okay? And essentially what mankind is telling God is, not only are we not going to try to reconnect the world with you, we are going to completely take it away from you. That's what mankind says. At this point, God says, that's quite enough. You guys are not making this happen. It's not happening. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to now engage in world 3.0. Okay, I'm not going to destroy everything. Rashi discusses why God did not destroy them again. Rashi says that this time they were united, and because of that unity, they were not completely destroyed. But God said that unity is being used for negative purposes. That unity is being used to rebel against me, so I'm going to destroy that unity and scatter you across the world. The 70 nations are created over here with their different languages and so on. Okay, God looks around the world and says, is anyone interested in my mission? Is there anyone who is capable, who has committed to reconnecting the world to its source, to me? And God sees one person. His name is Avram. Okay, and Avram at this point is a little bit over 50 years old. And the sources say that during this era, when the world was trying to rebel against God, Avram is walking around telling everyone, you know, there's one God and we really ought to serve him and listen to him and so on. And everyone rejected him, laughed at him, ridiculed him. No one was really listening at this point. And God looked down and God said, aha, I found my man. I found my man. There's one person on earth who, despite all the obstacles, has figured out what it's about. He gets it. He's willing to do it, despite all the challenges, despite everyone making fun of him, ridiculing him, trying to kill him, and so on. There's one guy down there who is willing to take on my mission. He's my man, and he's going to take on this job. And that's Avram. And so at this point, God says as follows. God says, the rest of the world, you are going to stay disconnected. You're going to be scattered. And I have one person, Avram. He will be the founder of my nation. He will become the creator of a people who will be connected, whose job will be to connect heaven with earth. They will have power over the spiritual reins of the world. What they do will not just affect their immediate physical surroundings, but it will affect the spiritual state of the entire world. They will be my nation of priests. This is where Avram is chosen from the rest of the world and to found a nation. So that's what's happening over here. So in terms of the difference between Jew and Gentile, it starts right at this moment when the rest of the world completely rejects God's mission of connecting. It says, no, 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 we don't want to connect. We want to disconnect. Thank you very much. We'll take control. We can fly this ship. God, you can, you know, stay where you are, and we don't want you. We don't need you. Avram says, no, that's a terrible idea. It's a terrible idea. And you think you can beat God at his own game, but it's not going to happen. And therefore, we need to connect heaven and earth. We need to connect the world back to God. We need to bring God back into creation. And at this point, God connects Avram to the spiritual. Well, different opinion exactly when he got connected, but the process of connecting Avram to the spiritual content of the world begins here. Okay, according to some sources, the final step in that process is when he becomes circumcised. Maybe we'll talk about that next week, perhaps. When he becomes circumcised, just very, very briefly, the idea of circumcision is removing the foreskin. Okay, without getting too graphic, it is removing the cover, okay, from the source of life. Again, without getting too graphic, it is removing that which covers the source of life by taking it away, okay, in a sense. And that's why circumcision is performed on the reproductive organ of the body, which is the source of life and continuity in the world. And the foreskin is looked at as a spiritual blockage on that ability to connect to the spiritual world. Again, needs more discussion. You can figure out some of it on your own probably, but I'm not going to get into that at length right now. The bottom line is, when did the Jewish people start? Well, it certainly started to some degree with Avram, in the sense that while the rest of the world chose to remain in the dark ages, in the sense that they said, we like our very externalized physical world. We don't need to connect to God. We don't want to connect with God. On the contrary, we want to take it for ourselves. Avram said, no, we need to connect. And here began a mission where God said to Avram, you are going to be the one and your descendants who will reconnect, who will bring me back into creation. Okay. And the rest of the world, their purpose, what will their purpose be? Their purpose will be to realize that mission, to help you in that mission, to follow along in that mission. Okay. That is going to be the idea. And hence God tells Avram in the beginning of next week's parasha that all the nations of the world will be blessed through you. In other words, you, Avram, will be the source of all spiritual goodness coming down to the world, will go through you. You are the pipeline. And so v'nivruchu b'chal kol goyei aretz, all the nations of the world will be blessed through you, is not just, well, you, Avram, can go run around blessing everyone. The deeper idea is that from here on in, all the spiritual content of the world is going to flow through Avram and his descendants. And anyone else who wants to connect to that can follow the Jewish people. They can convert if they want, okay? Or they can just help them out and connect to them and thereby become part of that mission as well, in a secondary sense. And that is how the Jewish people begin. We, again, begin with Adam and Eve crashing the world, disconnecting. We move through the generation of the flood, which instead of using all of their material goodness to conquer evil, they instead get sucked into it and they get destroyed. And then we have the generation of the dispersion, which tries to not only not take on God's mission, but to try to completely disconnect creation from God. And God says, that's it, I've had quite enough. There's only one guy on this planet who's interested in reconnecting. That's Avram. He's going to be the one to take on the mission, and anyone else in the world who helps him will be part of that, be part of that process, okay? If not part of the Jewish nation, but part of that process, and everyone else is out of the picture. The end. Okay? What does this mean for us? I think it's pretty straightforward. Well, it's actually the end of the beginning. I think the lesson for us is the responsibility that we have. We need to recognize as Jews that what we do matters. Everything we do matters. Okay? Our lives matter. Our actions matter. What we do matter. What we do matters. Not just in terms of our immediate surroundings, but everything we do. If we do something good, you are bringing more goodness down that pipeline into the world. If you do bad, then you are shutting off the pipeline from God's goodness to come into this world. So whatever we do matters. Everything little, everything big, everything makes a difference. I think that's a very important idea to keep in mind as we move through these weeks. All right, is there any comments? I'm happy to take them, or questions. Questions more than comments. And if not, we will call it a day. And yeah, go ahead.
What part did Sarah take? I mean, she was a prophetess.
Yeah. Avram and Sarah are the ultimate power couple in this sense. You know, they're doing this mission together. They're doing this mission together. And in fact, as we will discover in the coming weeks, it is the matriarchs who actually have a keener sense of raising the future generations than the patriarchs. Sarah's going to be the one who's going to say, Yishmael has no place over here. Rivka is going to be the one who recognizes that Esav has no place. So they are a major, major part in building. But yes, the patriarchs and matriarchs are a major part. So Avram begins this process. He brings Sarah, he marries her and brings her into the fold. She, by marrying him, accepts this mission upon herself as well. Where Lot fits in is a discussion unto itself. Avram takes Lot with him. Lot had an opportunity to become part of it, but he rejected it. You know, and the two parted ways. Yishmael has an opportunity to some degree become part of it, but he fails, he sins, and he is kicked out. And Esav has an opportunity to be a major player, but he also rejects it, and so he gets booted out. Ultimately, all of these people, Lot and Yishmael and Esav, have their place in the divine plan, but not as part of the Jewish people. Although Lot actually does become part of the Jewish people later, of course, with the conversion of Ruth, who is a descendant of Lot, and she actually becomes the founder of the Davidic dynasty and ultimately of the Messiah himself. So Lot plays a major role, but it's only going to come about many centuries later. Okay.
I have a comment.
Yeah, go ahead.
So Pastor Hagee and Faith Bible Chapel, their motto is, I will bless those who bless you, I will curse those who curse you. And it sounds like reward and punishment, but the way you describe it, it now turns into something like, here is a river of life, drink from it or go thirsty.
Yeah, or if you want to say a little, you could take it a step further, if you'd like, and say that in essence, those who bless you will be blessed and those who curse you will be cursed, is that because all of God's goodness comes through this pipeline of the Jewish people, so essentially cursing them is biting your nose to spite your face, you know, is basically what's happening. you know, because you are in essence biting, you are cutting off the source of what comes to you. And you will notice historically that countries where the Jewish people have lived in the diaspora, not always, but most of the time, have become quite successful, you know, on the world stage economically and politically. And after they've kicked their Jewish populations, if they were nice, they only kicked them out, you know, and so on. They have usually declined thereafter. You will see that historically throughout the diaspora, that's what has happened. Okay, because there it's actually a somewhat of a reversal of roles where they become the hosts for the Jewish people. And so they actually become, because they're the hosts, they benefit from that blessing. That's something to think about also. All right. People like to attribute the success of the Jewish people in the diaspora to their keen business acumen, to their wonderful scientific abilities, to their great genius and brilliance. But the truth is quite the opposite. It's that God takes care of his people, and the countries that host them also benefit, you know, from that blessing. So that's really what's happening. All right. I wish everyone have a wonderful day. Have a great week. And God willing, next week we will get back together.